In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time, and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spitero created Is It Jaws, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film. And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Just tell me one thing, Burke. You're going out there to destroy them, right? Not to study, not to bring back, but to wipe them out.
That's the plan.
All right, people, on the ready line. Iron Me! Yeah! Iron Me! Yeah!
Talk to me, Hudson.
I got signals. I got readings in front and behind.
There's nothing back here.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us.
Get them out of there.
Aliens. This time, it's war.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and this time out, I am joined by yet another married couple. This seems to be, I seem to have a trend of that going on. This time it is Brian and Beth Hughes. Welcome aboard, guys.
Hola.
Thank you. How's it going?
It's going well. How are you guys doing?
We're awesome. Doing good, staying quarantined. I'm pretty sure, like I hope the rest of the world is trying to do, except for the essentials and the heroes out there working.
Well, because of the quarantine, I'm actually getting a chance to get way ahead on my recording schedule. So I'm hopeful that by the time this airs, the quarantine will be nothing but a memory.
Oh, yeah, so that would be nice.
We will see. Nice. Oh, yeah. But Brian reached out to me and mentioned that Beth was interested, and I actually misunderstood. I thought Beth was interested in doing Alien until I got back to Brian this week, and he said, no, Aliens. Now, I have no problem with that. Because I like Alien, and I like Aliens, too. And I did not see Alien in the movies, but I did see Aliens, and enjoyed the heck out of it. I saw it in its original theatrical release, and it was one of very few movies. At the time I saw it, I was still living in Brooklyn. And, you know, there were decent theaters around in Brooklyn, but in Manhattan there were a couple of you know, very elaborate theaters that I don't think you know, even exist anymore. And me and one of my buddies traveled into Manhattan and saw this, I believe because it was on a limited release at that time. I think it was, you know, very early in its release schedule and had not yet gotten a widespread release into the local theaters in Brooklyn. And honestly, I did not get a lot of advance buzz on it, but I was pretty much hook, line, and sinker while I was watching it. I loved it. I hope I'm not giving away too much of my final rating here already, but how about you guys? How did you first experience this?
Well, every weekend we got to choose to go to a movie of our choosing, and we would take turns as a family picking a movie that we wanted to see. But this particular point in time, my parents, my brother, and myself, we had all agreed that we should go see this movie called Aliens. And we had seen Alien. And I was a lot younger then, so I don't really remember it that well. But Aliens, I remember so well. The nervousness I got just driving up to the theater, I was excited and scared all at the same time. And so my dad kept saying to me, you know, the last one was pretty good, although it's bullshit. He would always call something out when he didn't always, because it wasn't always believable, but Aliens, he really loved. He loved it very much, as did I. And not because of my parents, but because it was such a memorable time that we would all agree to go see a movie that we all wanted to see together. It wasn't an argument in the car. It wasn't an argument at home. It was something we all wanted to go see, which was pretty rare back then, because we would argue about what we wanted to see and whose turn it was. And so this movie actually had my family in complete agreement. So all the way in the theater and out of the theater, we were still talking about it. Even a couple of days later, we were still talking about the movie. So we definitely loved it, and it has a special place in my heart because I can remember the drive to the theater to see this movie.
I think as parents, we can all relate to, you know, I have two children, and if there's two things to be, or if there's a choice between two things to be decided upon, and you say, well, let me let the kids decide, almost invariably, they'll each want to do the one that the other doesn't.
Game over, man. Game over.
Why don't you just put her in charge?
Right, exactly.
So, if you give two kids a choice between two things, odds are they're not going to agree. So I could see where it would really stand out in your mind that you were all in agreement for this, because it was probably a rare occasion.
Yes, it was. That, and I think Star Wars was the same way for us, where my dad really wanted to see it, my brother wanted to see it, and I didn't want to see it until there was Ewoks in the theater. So all the other ones I didn't really want to see until there were Ewoks. And that movie I wanted to see more than any of the other Star Wars films, and my dad was like, I don't want to watch that. I just remember Aliens being one of the few movies that we all really wanted to see. So, yeah.
I'm you know, the thing about that gets me, and the thing here to keep in mind is her father was a Marine in Vietnam. And when you look at the movie Aliens, it's got a lot of, you know, Vietnam, I guess it's kind of like its own little Vietnam story, Vietnam War story.
Right.
So it's interesting to see that. And, of course, the fact that it is Marines going in. So I'm surprised at that, because her father was a badass. Now, as far as my experience on it, it's a bit different from y'all's, because I didn't see either Alien or Aliens originally in the theater. the first time I actually saw Alien was a friend of mine had gotten a hacked box for On TV, which is a local pay TV service. And he let me take it home. And so I had it at the house, and my dad and I were watching movies and stuff on it. And Alien came on. And so we sat down and watched that. We watched it in my room because I don't think he wanted my mom to know we were doing this. And so we're watching it. I've got a 19-inch black and white TV. And I tell you, that movie is even creepier in black and white. I mean, that really did. It's like I was, you know, that was, I was probably about 13 when I saw that, and that scared the crap out of me. But when Aliens came out, I was in college and I was working, and so I wasn't getting out to the theater as much because I was really, you know, giving my all to school at that point. And I had a movie party one weekend in my apartment. I just moved into a single bedroom apartment, and I had about 15 friends over. And one of them worked at a local grocery store, and he brought over a wash tub basin and a huge hunk of dry ice. And so we had all the lights off, and we're watching on the big 25-inch console TV. That was the biggest TV you could get then, I think.
Well, back then and, it was huge.
Yeah, I know. And so there's, like I said, 15 of us, and we're laid about. Some of us are on the couch. Some of us are in other chairs, and the rest are sprawled out on the floor. And as the movie goes on, the dry ice keeps gurgling as Mike is adding water and stuff to it. And so it's flooding over the floor. And by the time you get to the scene with the facehugger, there's a foot tall layer of mist, of you know, fog in my apartment. And everybody is crowded together on the couch. And so, like, the scene where it's just it got everybody creeped out, and everybody was folded up onto the couch, and it made it quite a good experience. I didn't see it in the theater, but I had a great experience watching it for the first time.
Cool. Yeah, so we all had positive experiences with this one right off the bat, at least.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I don't want to get too much into Alien because I think I'd want to do that on a future show.
Right.
But Alien, you know, was Ridley Scott, and it was kind of, you know, both all the Alien movies are science fiction as far as their general premise. But within the science fiction genre, each one has kind of a different tone to it. Alien is more of a horror movie. Aliens is more of an action movie with, you know, kind of a terror aspect to it. I rewatched it as I always try to do for the episode. And I was struck by how the aliens themselves are similar in many ways to what we see now in like zombie movies, how they, you know, they're just relentless and they keep coming and they, you know, there's no actual person except for the queen. There's really no personality to the, you know, the different aliens we're getting. There's different looks, you know, like you said, there's the facehugger. But they're all just relentless coming at you kind of thing.
Yes, definitely.
So, I wonder, you know, at the point this came out, we did have Night of the Living Dead. There was Dawn of the Dead. There was, I think Day of the Dead was around the same time as this. But otherwise, as far as zombie movies go, I don't think, you know, there were, I don't think there were any others that I, at least not that I know of. So, you know, this at the time this was made was more unique in its presentation.
Yeah.
And James Cameron was coming off Terminator. In fact, from what I saw on this, the producers of this movie made whether or not they were going to produce this movie contingent upon how Terminator came out. Because as I read it, Cameron, during a lull in production of the Terminator, had prepared his proposal for this movie, and the producers were on the fence about it. They liked the proposal, but Alien had not been enough of a moneymaker to necessarily qualify it as an automatic sequel maker. So they said, well, let's see how you do a Terminator, and if that's good enough, then we'll bankroll this. And obviously they did.
I am, for one So glad that they did it.
Sitting in
that theater, getting to see this movie, I was loving every minute of it. And for us to be talking about it even years later, I think it still stands up today with how well it was made, in my opinion. And I still watch it today.
Having just watched it for the purposes of the show, you know, I can say the same thing. I would say the only thing that appears dated to me are when they show you the computer graphics on their screens. They look like 1980s video game graphics.
This is true. Yeah. I agree.
But other than that, I don't think the movie looks dated at all. I think the special effects hold up. And that's kind of a James Cameron thing. He, you know, virtually every movie he's made, he's pushed the envelope as far as production values. And a lot of the things he made, you know, like it or not, you know, with Avatar or, for that matter, T2, you know, he came up with things he wanted to do in those movies that he had to wait for the technology to catch up to him so that he could actually do it.
Yeah, and The Abyss, too, because he had to, because they created the scuba masks that they used for filming in those.
And surprisingly, because it's not such a special effects-laden movie, but even Titanic had some aspects of it that, you know, they had difficulty with getting the technology to recreate the you know, the sinking of the ship and everything the way they did it, and they needed to, you know, use some computer graphics and the like. So, you know, he pushed the envelope every time, and I appreciate that aspect of his filmmaking. And unlike some other directors, I don't feel that he neglects the performances of the actors. I've talked in the past about how some directors who are special effects heavy worry more about those effects and don't really worry about if they've gotten the best performance out of their actors. I think he gets some great performances out of the actors in this movie.
Yes.
I think he really enjoys making them feel like they're really there. And that, I think, affects the performance in the actor. Besides the fact that I think he does a great job in casting most of the time, I think that he does care so much that it shows in his work, and it reads forward to the people sitting in the seats.
I think to some extent he has, it's almost a throwback in time, that he has kind of a core group of actors that he likes to work with, and they're all, you know, very good actors. But he, you know, he tries to find the part that fits them just right. But I mean, Bill Paxton was in quite a few of his movies. Lance Henriksen is a regular of his. Michael Biehn is a regular. Sigourney Weaver has been in multiple movies with him. So he finds actors that he likes the way they perform, and then he tries to see if he has a role that could fit them. The fact that he does a lot of his own screenwriting allows him to cater the role a little bit to the actor's strengths and weaknesses. The one that really just kind of surprised me is Carrie Henn, who played Newt, the little girl in the movie. She gave, in my opinion, a surprisingly mature performance for such a young girl. She doesn't seem to have that stilted way of speaking that young performers often do. And what really surprised me about it, because you do get that occasionally where you get a young actor that steps up and you know, performs beyond their years. But what surprises me is this is the only role she ever played. She didn't choose to go on with an acting career after this.
She became a teacher.
After showing such promise as a young actor. Made this movie? Probably 10, 11, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that surprises me. I was looking at the cast a little bit, and again, you know, a lot of the actors are people he's used over and over again. The one that I thought, like, and I had the wrong thought about it. I was thinking, oh, he cast Paul Reiser against type because, you know, ultimately Paul Reiser is kind of one of the bad guys in the movie.
Right.
But he really wasn't casting him against type because At the point when this movie was made, he didn't have a type. I was thinking he was already on My Two Dads by the time this came out, but that was a year later.
Yeah, I'd only seen him in, like, I think Beverly Hills Cop was before this. That was, what, 84?
That sounds about right.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, the funny thing is that, you know, Michael Biehn wasn't even in it until, like, a week before filming. Because James Remar was going to be playing the Hicks part.
I can't imagine that he would have done it better. He's an imposing actor, but I don't think he has the charisma that Michael Biehn does.
I don't think they would have had the chemistry that he and Ripley had together.
I agree with that.
And that would have hurt. And then again, you know, you wouldn't have gotten the great scene of the fact that, you know, some woman happens to be dragging Michael Biehn along the stage, the soundstage, in two movies in a row, you know, because it's Sarah Connor and Terminator and Ripley in this one.
That's true.
But you know, the other guys, they all had the benefit of going to like a boot camp with the British SAS. And Biehn didn't get to be a part of that. And he just got basically Remar's leftovers. You know, the armor that Remar was going to wear is what he had to wear. And he hated it because it had that heart on the chest. He thought that was like a big target.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, he was very good in the part. And you know, I didn't know a lot of that stuff until recently. So I was like, you know, it's just, you know, serendipity that everything came together the way it did. Or it was just Cameron was that good, because it was a troubled shoot over there, because shooting in England at the Pinewood Studios is a lot harder than shooting here. They expect 8-hour days, they expect tea breaks and such. And you know, here we expect 12 to 18 hour days, and you just keep going until it's done.
Yeah, I could see where that would create problems, especially, you know, budgetary.
Yeah.
The other I thought it was worth mentioning, the other person who's part of kind of the stock group for Cameron is Jeanette Goldstein, who plays Private Vasquez in this, because she plays John Connor's stepmom in T2, and you'd never look at her and think, oh, that's the same person.
True, and I absolutely love her in Aliens so much. I love that type of strong woman that you can buy the fact that she's a badass. And she sells that so well in this movie, just as Ripley does. But Ripley does it in such a different fashion than Vasquez does. But they're both so believable in their roles.
She also has, I think, the best line in the movie when Bill Paxton is busting her chops. You know, anybody ever mistake you for a man? No. Has anybody ever mistaken you for one? I just think that's so great. And he's another one, you know, Bill Paxton, you know, these guys are basically the Marines. And Bill Paxton is such a whiny guy in this, but he's never annoying. It's like it's comic relief, but he never feels like he's playing it for comedy.
Well, they cut him off just before annoyance.
Yeah, but I think they chose to present him well, because if he had been a little bit more over the top in the performance, it would have just seemed unrealistic and too much. But he really brings it right up to the edge of that, and then they pull
back. This was right after Weird Science, which in that one he played a total dick for comedy. And he was that annoying. He was that far over the top. So this was kind of like a step back.
Science. What part of that wasn't over, you know?
True.
He has some of the most memorable lines in the movie with the, why don't you put her in charge, or game over, man.
Yeah. And that was an ad-lib. Game over was an ad-lib. According to Cameron. Now, of course, the thing about Jeanette Goldstein was, and you, I don't know if you've heard this story, but you know how Bill Paxton's character makes the joke, you know, they said aliens, she thought they meant illegal aliens, and so she signed up. Yes. And the story is that when, you know, she was in England at the time when they had the casting call, and she honestly thought that they were talking about illegal aliens. So she showed up to her audition in Latina regalia. You know, she dressed the part of an illegal alien.
Well, I'm wondering how he, you know, if that's basically how he decided to do the character that way, or if he kind of had the idea all along. Who knows?
Well, she was supposed to read for a different role. She was reading for Pharaoh, the pilot, initially, is what they had intended. But they liked her better for the Vasquez part.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
So they gave her the first ever spray-on tan, and there you are.
Now, the computer screens notwithstanding, what do you think of the special effects in this movie?
Go ahead.
I remember sitting in that theater, and I just thought how wicked the aliens looked. And to me, the suits definitely looked better and much more believable than they did in the first Alien. And the small creatures, the ones that I guess that wrap around the neck, those were just freaky. They always, even today, still get me wanting to pick up my legs away from the edge of the bed. They have me kind of still pushing back against my pillow or the couch, wherever I'm watching it, because it's so creepy. And it's believable to me that there are things we may have not ever seen that react like this. But to think that it's possible that there are creatures out there we've not discovered yet, you just never know. And they look so believable to me.
Yeah.
And I know I may be jumping the gun here, but the queen, oh my gosh. The way that they made her so intelligent, actually all of them, the way that they would communicate with each other is another thing. And the fact that they had blood for acid, I mean, who in the heck thought that up? It's almost like, how can we possibly kill them and win in space without killing ourselves?
Well,
hurting ourselves?
I'll wait for his answer. They definitely up the stakes because, you know, the first movie has an alien that they have to deal with, and it's in confined quarters, and, you know, that's that. But then, you know, Cameron, decided, you know, what if they have to do a whole colony of aliens and deal with that? And I just think that really is just, you know, the natural progression here. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the way to go. And I think it was.
And then the way that they had people strapped up against the wall and you had to bring them down, the sticky,
cocooned,
ooey gooey that they would touch, it was. And the way they make it look hot and sweaty.
There was a tactile
dirty
sense of that set. Yeah. You know, like when Ripley is pulling Newt out of the cocooning that they did, I could feel that stuff. I could feel the weight of it and the gooiness of it and everything. The whole set felt ugly and dirty and wet and steamy. And you never for a moment, you know, didn't believe that she wasn't running around a place like that.
Yeah.
I know that this was like one of the first movies where I really started digging into what, you know, how the sausage was made. And, you know, I was looking for all the magazines, Cine Fantastique and Fangoria and whatnot, trying to see if they got anything on this one. And the thing that surprised me the most is how many miniatures they actually used for Hadley's Hope and, you know, a lot of the sets. They did a lot of miniature work. And I was just – I thought all that was real, you know, life-sized.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have the CGI then that they have – you know, that developed over the years, even, you know, what they'd have 5 years later in T2. And I guess to have them all be life-sized, I would think either you'd blow your budget trying to create those, or you would, if you saved on the budget, you'd have, you know, King Kong versus Godzilla looking outfits on these people, which just wouldn't work right. I think the special effects choices they made were just terrific.
And I agree.
You know, to think, you know, that this is a time where they pretty much had to do all practical effects, you know, it says a lot.
You know, they were sitting in a conference room with the blue collar guys showing them parts of this movie, and they were just thinking, wow, you must have blown your budget on all these sets. And he was like, well, actually, we did it. Those were miniatures. Sets that you saw, effects that were actually all tore up or blown up, and they were just like, wow, it seems so seamless and seems so real, like the actual sets that you were using, we couldn't even tell the difference. Yeah. And I still think that lives true today. You can't really tell very well, unless you're really looking and paying attention. It's hard to tell which is real and which isn't.
Which I know it takes a whole team of special effects people to do it, but I see it as an indication of James Cameron and, you know, his fastidiousness, yes. You know, and just, you know, his planning and all of that, that I just think he, you know, his movies just repeatedly show that level of attention to detail, and I think, you know, this one is no exception. I cannot comment on, what was it, Piranha 2, which I think is the movie he did before Terminator.
Yeah.
I can't comment on that because I've never seen that one.
I don't think that he really got to have as much to do with Piranha as he wanted. I think I understand there were some things that went on and he actually got locked out, though his name was still attached to it as the director. But one of the things I think that makes this one as good as it is how well he worked with Ray Lovejoy, who edited it. Because, you know, Lovejoy came from 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they had their disagreements. But ultimately, it was Lovejoy's editing of the final battle that convinced Cameron, you know, that this could be done. You know, because they were not getting along. And he was getting ready to fire him, but Lovejoy came and you know did an edit of the final battle, and then so there he went back and did the rest of the movie, and it's really, really tight. Of course, they had to make hard decisions on what to cut because it was going to be an over 3-hour movie. You know, when they got to the getting ready for the final cut.
Boy, I'd like to see the whole thing.
Well, you can. I mean, the cut that Cameron wants was one that, and it was one of the very first director's cuts that came out. When they started putting out laser discs, they released the director's cut of Aliens, and it had, you know, these extra scenes that we'd heard about, Newt's family, what happened to them.
Yeah.
So you get the flashback, you get to see what the people were like on Hadley's Hope before the aliens took over. And there was a scene early on where Ripley got to find out about her daughter. And they used a modified picture of Sigourney Weaver's daughter to look like her.
You know, I think I've only seen the director's cut maybe once or twice.
Hasn't
been any time recently, I don't believe.
I did see it years ago, and then when I watched it again for today, I watched it. It was streaming on HBO or HBO On Demand. So I watched it on there, which is just the traditional cut, not the
extended one. The original cut. Yeah, no, Cameron considers the director's cut his final cut, what he wanted to see. And Sigourney Weaver prefers that one as well because it strengthens the storyline of, you know, the motherhood aspect of her relationship to Newt.
Yeah, and which is very – you know, we talk about chemistry. The chemistry between Ripley and Newt is very visible. And
yes.
I give a lot of credit to, once again, the young actress, because you don't expect a performance of that magnitude from somebody that young very often.
True. I think the only other young actress I've seen with such a strong character on screen at that young age is Dakota Fanning. And this little girl has the same chops that she had at that age.
That's a good
much
comparison.
Much older. Mm-hmm. Yeah, much older than they are actually. They act so much older than that. But yeah, if she would have stayed in movies, I could see her at the same level as Dakota Fanning at that age for sure.
Now, just did you pay much attention to the score as you watched the movie?
I didn't. I really never. I personally never really pay attention to the score. Now, are we talking music score or are we talking
the musical score?
No. I can't really say that unless it's a musical film.
Yeah, she's never been much for instrumental.
I've always said that if you watch the movie and if you watch the movie and you're trying to immerse yourself in the movie and you're conscious of the score, they're probably doing something wrong. Because the score should be helping you to get the feelings that you want to get, but it should never be overpowering the movie. Even I've said this before, even movies that have some of the most memorable scores going, like Raiders of the Lost Ark or Superman the movie, right. When I first saw them and walked out of the theater, I didn't walk out and say, wow, that music. It took, you know, over time I became more aware of them. But the scores are excellent, and they do add to how you feel about the movie. Just it does so on a level where you're not always aware of it. And I think those are the best scores. In this instance, and for the show, a lot of times as I'm rewatching it, I try to pay special attention to take note of what the score is because it is part of the movie and it's something that I have interest in. So in this instance, when I rewatched it, I was listening for it, and a lot of it, to me, it's the score is by James Horner in this movie. I thought a lot of it sounded very military, almost like a march early on when they were doing, the prep for everything. Then the intensity of the music just ramped up as the movie went on, and then by the time we get to the final boss battle with the queen, it almost has like an opera-like feel to it. Like a Ride of the Valkyries kind of feel.
Exactly.
So I thought it was very effective in that respect. I don't know how it would be if I got a copy of the score on a CD and I popped it into my car radio and I listened to it as I was driving. I'm not sure. But as far as emphasizing the points of the movie and ramping up the feelings, I think it really did a good job.
And that's really fortunate because the way it worked out with Horner is that he only had a few weeks to be able to do it and he had to move on to another film. So he didn't score it based on an edit or a cut. So he had to sit there and score it and then provide the music to Cameron, and Cameron had to work with it to get it to fit how the movie went.
That's interesting.
So, yeah. Now, of course, he also, because he was so rushed on it, had to recycle certain themes and such. So if you listen to – and I didn't catch this until years later. I got a hold of a cassette of it and was listening to it. And I said, man, this sounds like Star Trek III. This sounds like Star Trek II. This sounds like Battle Beyond the Stars. I caught bits and pieces of other soundtracks in there because he had to sit there and recycle certain themes. And years later – when he scored Patriot Games with Harrison Ford, you hear some of his score in that too.
It's interesting because I've criticized a couple of movies recently where I thought the score sounded like good music, but it didn't necessarily sound like it fit what we saw on the screen. It almost sounded to me like they said, oh, this is good music, just put it in there, as opposed to being composed to heighten the feelings of the particular scene that we were watching. Now, in this instance, you're telling me to some extent that kind of happened, and yet it blended very well. So I guess it's either serendipity or Cameron did a great job of working with it.
Yeah, and on top of that, I mean, for years on afterwards, the music from this score was used in virtually every movie trailer that had action scenes in it. I mean, you can probably count on your, you know, and they even used some music from this at the end of Die Hard. So, you know, we were talking about the cast and we got away from that. And there, you know, we hadn't talked about the background characters like Apone and Spunkmeyer and Pharaoh and all that.
And Gorman.
And Gorman. And, yes, there's just, you know, as they are integral to the story. And every one of them was so good in their part, and you don't realize much. But it, one of the things I found out was that the guy that played Apone, the sergeant, he came up around the same time as R. Lee Emery. And so they were both served in Vietnam. You know who R. Lee Emery is, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Full Metal Jacket, for anybody
who knows. Right. And Full Metal Jacket was filming at the exact, pretty much at the same time over there that this was being filmed. In fact, the character that plays Frost was supposed to be in Full Metal Jacket. He was cast in both movies, but he turned it down to go ahead and do Aliens. But R. Lee Emery and Al Matthews that plays Apone, they pretty much came up at around the same time.
See, I don't know why, but Al Matthews seems younger than Emery to me.
And I mean, the thing is, we've only seen, you know, Al Matthews in a few things. I know that he was in, like, he was a fireman in Superman 3, and he was in Fifth Element. But we don't see him in a whole lot of stuff. But I remember him from Superman 3. That's pretty much the only thing that really stuck out to me. But, yeah, I mean, he was one of those guys like R. Lee Emery that, you know, he was because he was a sergeant, you know, in the Marines, he was getting typecast for that part. Like R. Lee Emery, that's pretty much all he did.
Right. Well, sadly, Matthews passed away in 2018.
Yeah, the same year R. Lee Emery passed away, too, which is really weird. Yeah. And he was also a folk singer.
Really?
He had a lot of music out. He was very well known for that, more so than, I mean, at least over in Europe, more so for that than his acting.
That's pretty interesting. Any other of the minor characters that you think were worth bringing up?
Well, you know, I was saying about Gorman, what surprised me about him is he kind of sneaks up on you when you think of him kind of as the last character that you really don't think about. But he really made you hate his, I guess you could say, chicken way of handling, or his inexperience really came to show through, you know, about being able to handle the situation where Ripley has to step in. But when I think about that, how much he showed that, it was really good acting on his part. I have to say, even from the least character like his, for all the screen time he got, I believed his inexperience. And
oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, and it would just make me so upset that he was so bad at it. And you know, you just want to see him save his people, and he just did nothing, and it made me angry.
And I don't think he had done a whole lot of acting up to that point. I know he was, like, in Scanners, but you didn't really get to see him. He was some guy in a hazmat suit. But I hadn't seen him really in anything since. Though I understand he's really, really big in that whole Thomas and Tank, you know, the tank engine. And Friends. Yeah, he's a big part of that.
I'm just looking at his – I just opened up a page of his, and I'm looking, and I saw they did have a picture of Thomas the Tank.
Yeah.
Yeah, always in his – looking at his Wikipedia page, he's got a lot of mentions of Thomas the Tank in different things. I had no idea he was in that. I'm just trying to look for things that we would, you know, would be generally well known by people. Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow, he played American Broadcaster.
Yeah, he seems to be doing more voice work than anything, because he's doing a lot of video games.
Oh, interesting. In the original Poltergeist, he played Dana's boyfriend in the car.
Really? I didn't know that. And I remember that scene for sure.
I remember that movie, but I can't picture that scene offhand.
Oh, yeah, where she gets out of the car and she's yelling at the house. That was, yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
I don't. I've watched Poltergeist once.
Oh, yeah, but you don't like scary movies, but yet here you are.
I like scary movies, all right. I just don't like certain types of movies. That's all goes back to my parents, you know, taking me to see The Exorcist when I was like 7 years old. It was a bad call, Ripley. A bad call.
Yeah, well, we've covered the Exorcist on the show, and to this day, it's still the most scary movie I ever saw, and I didn't see it until I was like 16. So.
Oh my gosh, me too. And I will admit, right here, right now, it's still the scariest movie I've ever seen ever, and I didn't watch it again. I went to see it with my parents when I was 3.
Oh my really. God.
And I remember it still climbing over my dad's shoulders. I could not get far enough away from the screen, and I was crying, and I was 3. And you can imagine a kid at the age of 3. I think I slept with them for like 2 or 3 weeks, and I would have nightmares about this movie. And then I did not watch it again until I was probably about 28 or 29 years old, all the way through, to try to overcome my fear of it, because that's how scared I was, how traumatized I was from a child at the age of 3 to finally get to watch it in my adulthood.
To keep going on that tangent, the movie I saw at an inappropriately young age that gave me nightmares was The Birds, the Alfred Hitchcock movie.
I had
nightmares about that scene with Tippi Hedren in the bedroom when the birds all attack her. I had nightmares for quite a while after seeing that one as a young, very young kid.
I had nightmares that someone actually named their kid Tippi. but when we saw The Exorcist, we were into a drive-in theater in a station wagon, and every so often my dad would just turn to us kids and say, "Y'all know this really happened." I think we did something to tick them off. Seriously, I don't know what it was, but that was definitely punishment. What movie were we talking about?
So, yeah, back to Aliens. One of the things I liked about this movie and the way they set it up was Ripley using the loader early on in the movie. And it's presented early on in the movie as if it's a scene just to show you, look how competent she is. But it's just seeding the film so that later on when she uses it, it's, you know, it's Chekhov's gun, but they didn't have to bring it back because, again, you could have it in that early scene just for the sake of developing her abilities.
You want to hear something really funny?
Sure.
Is that our daughter spent the last 3 years driving forklifts around.
So she's ready to go fight aliens.
Yes, she is.
So, and that's I think that's just a great scene when she comes out with the loader and, you know, get away from her, you bitch. It's just so well done. And, you know, it's presented, in my mind at least, it's presented as being fairly believable because she's, you know, she's pretty competent at using this machinery, but it is a slow moving thing. It's not something where, you know, she's going to be totally outclassing the beast, but it's just enough for her to hold her own, keep it away from her, and, you know, whack it in the head a couple of times.
Give Newt time enough to run away. But she doesn't.
Is it a disappointment that she ends up defeating the queen the same way she defeated the alien in the first movie, by letting it out the airlock? Is that a disappointment? Should they have come up with something unique?
No, not to me. It's not a disappointment, only because if it worked the first time, might as well try to make it happen a second time. But the way that she did it was so, I mean, it was so strong. It was so, they're so used to seeing women not being able to do anything, and to watch Ripley just be this badass woman. I just love that about strong women characters. Not all women can sell that type of strong, capable women. You just don't always buy it. But yeah, with Ripley and Vasquez, you do. And the fact that they're on the team together, and then you've got this little girl who you can see taking after them, that it's a whole new generation, because she survived on her own on this place for so long without any help. And I mean, that right there, just, I love that about this movie so very, very much. And there are very rare times I get to actually see a woman who, in my opinion, can carry the screen that way. And Ripley's always pulled it off in this movie that way. And I just love that. And watching her defeat the alien stuck with me from a small kid all the way into my adulthood. I just, for main reasons, I still love this movie because of that.
And Cameron's kind of built a career. I mean, most of his movies have those strong female characters. You know, Linda Hamilton and turning into that in Terminator. Jamie Lee Curtis turning into that in True Lies. And, of course, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio in The Abyss. And if you haven't watched The Abyss, you need to get out and find the director's cut of that and watch it.
I've seen The Abyss, but, you know, much like you with The Exorcist, I've seen it once. Was that a different movie that you mentioned you saw once?
No, The Exorcist, and that's Joe Piscopo mode, yes, once.
I saw it once. Honestly, I was not overwhelmed by it, and I never gave it a second shot, but I think I do need to give it another airing and, you know, specifically with the director's cut on that one. Anything else on this one that you think needs to be mentioned at this point?
Well, you know, she kind of brought it up here a little bit, and I was thinking about, you know, the Terminator and this one, and how in the Terminator you've got, you know, that ending where you think after the Terminator gets run over by the 18-wheeler, okay, that may be it. And no. Then the Terminator gets blown up in the 18-wheeler. You think, okay, that's it. And no, there he comes again. Then he gets blown up with Reese. And you think, okay, that's the end. And no, here he comes again. It keeps ramping up the tension a little bit more each time, and just, you know, getting you to the edge of your seat. And he does the same thing here. You know, you got the thing with the her, you know, blowing, you know, burning all the eggs. And I'm sorry, Beth is going to have to talk about that one scene when Ripley finally comes across the Queen. And the Queen, you know, she and the Queen kind of have that silent agreement. I'm not going to fry your eggs. You're not going to kill me.
Yes.
And then one of the eggs opens up.
And that right there, just the way that Ripley tilts her head is like, oh, no, you're not. No, you just did not do that to me. Because that was letting her know either way that she was going to be dead if she didn't become very aggressive and take her out. You know, the only thing I think where she went wrong is shooting the yolk sac so she would tear away. Otherwise, she could have just nuked her from the sky and she would have not torn away from her yolk sacs. Yeah. But that whole scene right there is just a silent understanding between mothers. I mean, even though she was not Newt's biological mother, she made a promise to that little girl. And she, because she had her own daughter, was definitely not going to let anything happen to her. She felt an obligation to make sure that that little girl did not stay behind. Right. And to watch her protect Newt to that amount of motherly love that you would feel for someone, and then watch the Queen get really angry because of the way she killed her kids. I mean, you've got two head of households, you know, basically going at it.
Yeah, true bitch fight.
True bitch
fight. If there yes. was hair free, they would have pulled it. But,
yes.
And of course, you get the idea that maybe the queen could have been killed in that first bit there, but obviously she escapes and comes up the elevator.
Right.
And then, you know, they get away in the ship as, you know, Bishop comes in, they fly away and boom. And you're like, okay, God, thank God. Okay. We're at the end. And then of course they get out and then there's the queen again. And, you know, Cameron keeps ramping up the tension yet a little bit more. And you're just along for the ride. And it's, you know, that multiple ending thing where you think it's over and it's not, you think it's over and it's not. And that was just great.
You know,
it
was,
and it never
the
felt
theater.
Like it never felt like they were playing you for a fool, though.
No,
it didn't. And I remember sitting in the theater, and when she's talking to what was the AI guy's name?
Bishop.
Thank you. When she's talking to Bishop, and all of a sudden he's being stabbed from behind, that was the last thing that I expected. I thought for sure it was over when they made it off. I never thought for a minute that she hitched a ride. And
when it first started coming out of his chest, did you think for a moment that an alien was popping out of his chest the first time
absolutely.
You saw it?
I absolutely thought that. And how in the heck was that even possible until I saw her standing behind him, then I realized exactly what was happening. But
I think that was exactly the
was
feeling you were supposed to get. I think that was
yes.
what they wanted you to think.
And it succeeded, definitely. You know, they used Derry in that scene there. They didn't do that in the first movie, but in this one they used Derry, and Lance Henriksen got so sick from all of that, because under the hot lights and everything, that stuff got hot and got nasty.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. But Lance Henriksen played, you know, an android so well.
You believed it, yeah.
Yeah, he was likable, but he, you know, you always felt like he could end up, you know, because she had the bad experience with the android in the first movie.
With Dash, yeah.
Right.
So, you know, that you
and
felt
the
like
scene with
happened.
Him in the tube, what was right. that a...
The
that
claustrophobic
tube
scene.
Got in? Yes. Oh my gosh. I couldn't even have pretended to get in that thing. I would have felt like I was suffocating for sure.
Yeah. Well,
that was.
It was definitely worse in Shawshank Redemption, but you know, hey. Now the other scene I wanted to bring up though. And I'm jumping away from Lance Henriksen, though. And I'd say it's probably one of the more tension-filled scenes in the whole movie, is when Ripley and Newt are in the infirmary and they realize that the facehuggers have been set free. And when, you know, they're waiting for the Marines to come get them, you know, Ripley set off the alarm, and then one gets to Ripley and she's sitting there fighting it off. I'll be honest with you. I was sitting there on the couch in my apartment with all my friends there, and I was kicking to get away from that facehugger. I was physically kicking to get away from it, not realizing that I was doing that in front of all my friends. They were laughing at me.
When a movie can get that kind of a physical reaction out of you, they're definitely doing something right.
Yes. And you never for a moment do you – in this movie, it's just there are only a few little chinks in the armor that slip from time to time. And the only one that I've ever really noticed is when in the final scene, as Ripley's opened the door and Newt is sliding across the floor and Bishop, half of Bishop, reaches to catch her, you can actually see a little bit of the hole that he's standing in.
And I did not see that.
The edge of the manhole. Now you won't be able to unsee it, unfortunately.
Well, I'm going to do my best not to look at that.
I actually really do my best not to look at it now, but for a number of years, yeah, I always saw it every time. But, yeah, I mean, typically stuff like that in this movie, they're slick enough with it that you don't catch those things very often. And that's just one thing. Very well done.
Yeah, I agree.
So do I.
I'm trying to think if there are any other little bit. Oh, there is one other thing I wanted to bring up. And that is in the director's cut, they use those robot sentry guns. Do you remember that scene? Do you recall that from the director's cut? And they used these really cool laptops to control them. And those laptops were actually real grid case laptops. They're magnesium case, incredibly durable. Our soldiers used them in the military. We had them aboard the space shuttles, controlling systems on the space shuttles. The company that I worked for in the 90s, where I learned to work in computers, was AST, and they had bought the grid government resource computer division away from Tandy years before. And so my job was actually to support those laptops. And I got to mess around with a couple of those. And they are just, you know, when you sit there and you think about computers today, you really can't, you can't drop one. If something falls off the table, it's probably broke. These things, they could shoot with a gun and not damage them. A soldier in Desert Storm took a mine, went off behind him, and the laptop took the brunt of the explosion, and the laptop still worked after that. These were really, really tough laptops. And so it gave me a source of pride to see that on the screen.
Well, that's really cool.
That is pretty cool.
Yep.
Now, did anyone get the feeling that Hicks and Ripley were really flirting back and forth on this in the movie?
I thought there was chemistry between them, and there was clearly a respect and a relationship between them. But I don't think there was ever any kind of romantic thing.
In the director's cut, they have one little scene at the end where she's going to get Newt, and they both tell each other their first names. And his name was Dwayne. And, I mean, that was really it. That's all there was to say. And if you've watched the following sequels, then you know what happens there.
Yeah.
Though there's a series of Dark Horse comic books that came out before Aliens, you know, the third one, and they followed Newt and Hicks. You get to see them, you know, afterwards, and you see how messed up Hicks is from the acid that got on him. But again, they're Dark Horse books. They're written by Mark Verheiden. And they're pretty good stories, but they don't necessarily have the same flair that this has. Doesn't have the same feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to recreate that, especially when you have a movie like this where it's so frenetic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the right word for it. It's hard to create that feeling in a comic book. I think, you know, if you were talking about like the first movie with the, you know, the haunted house feeling that they created in that, I think you can create that in a comic book more easily.
Yeah, and, you know, as far as recreating it in a movie, I think the one person that did a really good job of trying to recreate it later was Jonathan Frakes when he directed Star Trek First Contact.
Yeah, that did have, you know, the Borg had a little bit of that, you know, the zombie feeling to it.
Yes. And then, of course, the Borg Queen, not quite like this alien queen, but still, yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel there. I guess at that point it would be about 20 years later? I'm trying to remember. No, actually, First Contact was probably around 1998, 99, somewhere around there maybe?
Yeah, so about 12 years later.
Right. Okay, so I guess we are at the point where I'm going to ask you guys, is it Jaws?
It's definitely Jaws to me.
Okay.
No need to go over the scale for us.
Maybe for the listeners, but for me, Jaws.
And I think one of the things that most people don't realize is that aside from, say, Rambo First Blood Part 2, there wasn't action movies like this coming out yet. This was like at the beginning of that of that rush, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, Cameron helped write the script for Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Yes, but, that's true.
But I mean, that seemed to be the start of that, you know, guns and run kind of punchy run, as others like to say. But, you know, this was at the beginning, of course, with a woman as the hero and everything. It was also the first of its kind like that, really. We weren't getting that. And, you know, now, of course, it's a staple in a lot of the movies, especially, you know, when you look at the things that have come out of that franchise, you know, AVP that came later and Sana Lathan and her role in Aliens versus Predator. You know, they definitely took a look at Ripley and said, can we make her partly like this? But, I mean, Ripley is just now one of those characters that everybody looks at. You know, it's like the first. So, yeah, it's Jaws.
And I'm going to make it unanimous because I think this movie pretty much hits on all cylinders. I really don't think there's a misstep anywhere in it. I think the feeling I got when I watched it the first time, it's hard to duplicate that feeling because it was all brand new to me, and it was still, you know, again, I was sort of, you know, one of the best theaters in Manhattan, and we don't quite get to that level, but it still brings it all back every time I see it. And again, like I said, I think it hits on all cylinders. I don't think there's really a misstep in there. So I'm gonna rank it as Jaws as well. And if you haven't seen this, I definitely recommend it, obviously. Thanks, guys, for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
I appreciate the time, and this was fun. So you want to just tell everybody where they can find you?
Yes, you can find me right now. We're putting Third Degree Burnout pretty much on a weekly basis while the whole coronavirus lockdown's been going on. I don't know if that, you know, once things ease up, if we're going to be able to continue that pace, but I really hope so. It's, you know, it's kind of risen the profile of the show, and we're getting a lot more downloads than we had previously. So, yeah, Third Degree Burn at TwoTrueFreaks.com.
Okay, everybody.
That's all I got.
Everybody should be getting that on a regular basis as well. And once again, just thank you for coming on with me, and we'll see you all in 2 weeks.
How long after we're declared overdue can we expect a rescue?
17 days.
17 days? Hey, man, I don't want to rain on your parade, but we're not going to last 17 hours. Those things are going to come in here just like they did before, and they're going to come in here, and they're going to come in here, and they're going to get us!
This little girl survived longer than that with no weapons and no training. Right?
Why don't you put her in charge?
You better just start dealing with it, Hudson. Listen to me. Hudson, just deal with it because we need you, and I'm sick of your bullshit. Okay.